This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, this is Cruise Control, the car show here on BFM. My name is Arif Roos, and as usual, on the phone lines with me is Mr. Daniel Fernandez. Say hello.
Hello, Arif, and it's fantastic to be back again on BFM in 2021.
New year, new hopes, am I right?
Hopes? No, I think it's going to be the same year again. But you know, it's 2021.
Richard is still not around this week because he caught a cold.
Are you sure he's got a cold? I think, you know why? You know, like, expect, like, you know, after New Year celebration, you know?
He recently sent us a photo of a BMW 6 Series that he's, you know, thinking of buying. Sorry to spell it out, Richard, but it's just got to be done, you know?
when you're on Malaysian expat salary, you can afford cars like this. I mean, a BMW 6 Series. How much is this man earning?
With a 3-liter as well.
Exactly.
I suppose it's actually time to do the news.
Yes.
So let's do it. Before we get into all of the nasty stuff that's been happening in the past week or so, quite an interesting piece of news that popped up was that Norway is currently the first country where EVs, electric vehicles, have finally outsold internal combustion engine cars. So that's very, very interesting, isn't it?
It is very interesting, and it's something that should be inspiring Malaysians, you know, inspiring Malaysians to say we should start adopting electric cars. Not plug-in hybrids, because to me, plug-in hybrids are just like a speed bump. You're trying to, you know, okay, like, yeah, you know, I'll slow down a little bit, but, you know, I'm actually going to keep going faster, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And the figures that they gave out as well, you know, 54.3% of cars sold in Norway were actually electric vehicles like Teslas and Mercedes EQCs and all of those stuff.
And the Nissan Leaf and the Renault Zoe and the Golf E.
Yeah. 45% of them were plug-in hybrids, petrols or diesels. And here's some interesting numbers regarding the sales of specifically diesel vehicles, because they were everywhere in Europe at one time, right? In Norway in 2011, diesel cars had a 75.7% market share. But in 2020, just 9 years later, diesel cars has an 8.6% market share. And that's about the same for plug-in hybrids as well. So I guess this is proof that, you know, if we are willing to make all these changes, we can adopt electric vehicles.
But remember this, Norway does not have a national car program. So as long as we have a national car program, this will not happen in Malaysia. Not in my lifetime.
Well, should we start talking about some serious stuff?
Yes, something about holes.
Yep, we covered this a bit last week, but you know, the issue kind of takes about 3 weeks, 4 weeks to develop and then disappear from the face of our earth.
Yes.
Some frustrating news to start. Last week, there were a lot of news reports about more motorcyclists getting injured or even killed by potholes. It's a very, very, very serious issue, but apparently the Works Ministry or the Works Department, the JKR, you know, they haven't really said anything about that. They haven't come out with a press conference other than saying, you know, there are 11 different places where you can make your complaints about the road. The Works Minister and his deputy are silent. The government is dealing with a lot of other things, but they are still, I feel, kind of ignorant about how they're supposed to deal with the potholes. It seems like they're just blindsiding it, I think.
Well, I'll tell you this. I have personal knowledge of how potholes are fixed from 30 years ago. And I can tell you this. The JKR have ample knowledge and expertise to fix potholes. Contractors have ample knowledge and expertise to fix potholes. They choose not to, because if they fix it, they can't come back and fix it and earn more money via local orders. Town councils and JKR engineers and TAs always give out this local order. Local order means it's something below 10,000 ringgit. I'm talking about 30 years ago. Maybe today it's still valid.
Yeah.
You don't have to go through a tender process or anything else. You just give out the order, like literally giving it out every day. And the profit margins are 200-300%. And these guys just go out there and just do a simple job. Now, while all this was happening, okay, today is Wednesday. Yesterday, yep. Tuesday, I'm driving in PJ and I saw a huge 10-ton MBPJ truck with 5 employees doing quick hole patch up around Petaling Jaya SS2 Section 16, Section 17, Section 14.
Yeah.
Now, I like to applaud them for doing this. It was also drizzling. They were getting down, stopping the truck, doing the patch up, going to the next one patch up. But they were not pressing down on the tar or not giving enough time for the tar to settle.
I guess a good analogy would be like, you know, just putting a Band-Aid on things, right? Exactly. Not really fixing the problem.
And it's not even a good Band-Aid. I mean, visually it looks great, but you know, as cars go up and down, the tar, the little pebbles will start coming out and the pothole will reappear. Is it a solution? It's just making money for the suppliers of the raw materials and for the contractors. But in this case, it was a mudless Pembangunan Petaling Jaya, so they're not actually making money out of it. They are putting their workers to use.
And as usual, it's always the quality of the work that comes into light. But what exactly happens when you hit a pothole, and can you challenge the fact that you've fallen down due to a pothole?
So can you take the government to court?
Basically, there is actually a legal precedent for people to receive some sort of compensation from the government and JKR for pothole neglect.
Right.
So recently, Free Malaysia Today, they released an article about a man who recently won a suit against the government and JKR's director general himself for the injuries that he sustained when his motorcycle hit a pothole. So he filed the suit in 2014. After 6 years, on December 31st, 2020, he finally won the court case and he won 48,800, which would probably just about cover his cost of the legal fees, isn't it?
I think the lawyers made more money than that.
Well, they fought pretty hard. But the story is, the government received this suit and then they filed third-party claims against their own contractors, which is a company called Unic Sejati.
Right.
And then these contractors filed a claim against their subcontractor, Salam Dutamas. And they fought really hard against it. You know, they said that this guy who got injured as a result of this pothole actually just randomly fell down somewhere else, even though there was clear evidence that there was a pothole where he was pointing out.
Right.
But, you know, in the end, all three of them, the government, the contractor, and the subcontractor were actually found liable. So that's justice served, I guess.
So, I mean, the main point of the story is, why is there a subcontractor for a road contract?
Exactly. It's just the way things work here,
exactly.
I guess, right?
So let's not say the elephant in the room. Let's leave it as it is. We know what's going on right now.
Yeah. And I think we will move on to our next story, which is about 70cc bike licenses for youths between ages 16 to 20. So basically, the RMP, Royal Malaysian Police, is looking at introducing a B3 category for teenagers. This idea was actually mooted by Consumers Association of Penang in 2007 and again in 2019 by the Institute of Road Safety Research. And they said that this move would curb the increase in number of road accidents and deaths involving high-powered motorcyclists and youths aged between 16 to 20.
Right.
Just some statistics that they showed. 64% of 6,167 road deaths involve motorcyclists in 2019, of which a majority of these accidents involve teenagers. So, I don't know, Daniel, what do you think?
Okay, to start, a 70cc motorcycle is not slow. You can do very serious harm with a 70cc motorcycle. You can even do a harm on an electric scooter, right?
Yeah.
You know that and I know that. Now, the question here is not about how many cc. I'll give you an example. My son wants a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to buy him a motorcycle as long as he's got the right gear, the right mind frame, and the right attitude in riding a bike. But
mm-hmm.
the problem is, A, potholes. Let's put that aside, okay?
We just spoke about this.
Number two, other riders. Now, every day, every single day, we see young riders breaking the law. I have taken pictures on DSF, on my Facebook page, of riders not wearing helmets around their neighborhoods. I will even name the neighborhoods. You don't have to listen to me right now. Just take your car, take your motorcycle, tell PDRM just to go down to Kampung Kurinci, Bangsa South, Kampung Medan, Kelana Jaya, and ride around and see the number of young teenagers on motorcycles without helmets riding around. Some of them riding in the wrong direction. They do this every day. Nobody stops them. The police cannot control them. What's going on?
There is that famous video that went viral about 2 weeks ago, something like that, where a policeman on a motorcycle was sitting at a red traffic light and motorcyclist just flew past him. and he just sat there and looked. It seemed normal to him, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, the 70cc really doesn't make a difference. You can injure anybody at even 30 kilometers an hour.
Exactly.
And a few commenters online pointed out that actually 70cc motorcycles are pretty much non-existent these days,
true,
aren't they?
Because most of them are 100, 125, 110. The thing is, we have, like, if you go to Gombak, Batu Caves area and all that, you see so many of these teenagers riding with their helmets, riding with their sisters, brothers, some of them riding with their, you know, infants, you know, on their lap.
Yeah.
because it's like neighborhood, nobody gives a care. But the problem now is enforcement. So I've actually spoken to traffic police people in the past.
Yeah.
Because I wrote an article about this and the traffic police was not too happy with me. They called me in, but they're very polite. They wanted to explain their point of view. And this is what happened in a nutshell. They have roadblocks. They catch these youngsters. They also catch people that don't have licenses, take away the bikes. They make them walk all the way back to the police station with their bikes. They impound the bikes. They call in their parents. They talk to the parents. Parents tell them, I got no money. I'm poor. I come from an underprivileged family. I just send my son or daughter to just pick up a loaf of bread or pay a bill or whatever else. It was just around the corner. They give all kinds of excuses. And then they say, that motorcycle is my transport for my livelihood. Please don't impound it. And then after some negotiations, they pay a small fine. The bikes are released to them. 2 days later, they are back on the road doing the same thing over and over and over and over again.
It's almost inevitable, right?
Yeah. I mean, so you can't really blame the police. But then what are you going to do? Are you going to allow these children to keep riding? I mean, if you go outside a lot of Sekolah Kebangsaan's in these neighborhoods, you see riders coming out, schoolboys in school uniform, without helmets, some of them without licenses, going home with their friends. Police are having problems trying to stop these people. JPJ has also been called in to help out. So how do you stop them? I've been for motorcycle licensing school. The education system to get a license, they're very strict about taking care, helmet, safety, jacket, shoes, and everything else. But the moment they get their license, all that is thrown out and they just carry on. It's just like parents putting a child on their lap and driving, you know?
Yeah.
So what do we do? That's all.
Shall we finally actually talk about cars?
Yes, please. Yes, please. I'm getting very impressed.
Yeah, same. We have two cars launched. They are affordable cars. They're Toyotas and they're facelift. So the first one is a Toyota Fortuner facelift. Can you tell me about that, Daniel?
Okay, the Fortuner. You know and I know this has been a popular vehicle many years ago and then it slowly sort of died down. Then there was a bit of a resurrection about 5 years ago when they did a facelift of this model. And then it slowly died down. And the reason for this is very simple. The Fortuner, it's tough. It's able, you know, it's a proper 4x4. But you know and I know when people are paying 170, 180, 200,000 ringgit for a car, they're not going to go off-road. Okay? No. They'll buy a pickup truck to do that. So a lot of people who had families bought this because it was a 7-seater. But what happened is in the last 5 years, Mazda came out with a beautiful 7-seater. Hyundai has got the Santa Fe. Mitsubishi has got the Pajero Sport.
Yep.
A lot of family-friendly, more comfortable car-like 7-seater SUVs came out. Mm-hmm. And so the rough and tumble, rugged Toyota Fortuner lost its appeal.
Like with this facelift, you know, they redesigned the front and realized they got new bumpers, updated interior. They even added Toyota Safety Sense.
Oh, the safety features on this is very, very good. Yes.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, basically the whole suite. Yeah. They even added a more muscular engine from the Hilux, which is a 2.8-liter four-cylinder turbo diesel. Yes. But I can't help but think for 203,000 ringgit for the top-line model to the 2.8 VRZ, that's quite a price to pay considering you find a bit more amenities in like a Hyundai Santa Fe or something like that, you know?
I'm glad you mentioned that because the direct competitor is the Hyundai Santa Fe. The next rival will be the Kia Sorento and both of them are more car-like in their mannerisms on the road, you know? And this is very truck-like, even though it looks nice, but, you know, with all that safety features and everything, you can't get away from that ultimate comfort that you get driving on the road.
Yep.
Nobody's going to take this off-road. Maybe in Sabah and Sarawak, some timber tycoon might say, okay, I want to take it off-road. But then he'll go and buy himself a Prado.
Yeah, that's true.
or a top-of-the-range Ninja Turtle Land Cruiser. He's not going to buy a Fortuner. He might buy a Fortuner to go and buy a loaf of bread, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But the next car that Toyota launched alongside the Fortuner was the Innova facelift.
Yes.
Basically, another three-row car.
Right.
It's an MPV. Okay. And used to be popular at one time as well, right?
Yes, very popular. Also very popular with people doing long-distance taxi services. Because why? When you put on the third row, there's a huge luggage space. It is actually quite a comfortable vehicle, even though it's a very old chassis. It looks very stylish. I actually like the red color on this. But again, I think, you know, a lot of Malaysians look at it and said, it's a very minor facelift. Yes, they've added a lot of features. They put the body kit, the interior, the touchscreen and everything else. But end of the day, at this price, and I'm going to say it very, very sorry to say it, the Proton X70 seems like a better bet.
Unless you want that third row, which in that case, you'll probably buy an Exora or a Rush.
And then if you want that third row also, exactly how comfortable is that third row? Because you're sitting at the back, the suspension is right there. You're going to be bouncing a little bit even in city roads. But still, I've been in the Innova, I've driven it, I've had my family in the back. It's quite comfortable. But still, the SUV pull seems to be better. And also, the Proton X70 is cheaper.
Yeah.
You can't fight the national car tax system.
Definitely. Anyway, that's all for part one of this show. We spoke a little bit about a couple of Toyota facelift launches, and then we spoke about, you know, 70cc bikes and potholes as usual. Stick around for part two as I will review my own car, a BMW E90 325i, and go through a little bit of an ownership review, I guess, about it.
Hoorah!
Stay tuned right here on BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, this is Cruise Control, the car show here on BFM. My name is Arif Roos, and as usual, with me on the phone lines is Mr. Daniel Fernandez. Say hello.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to 2021.
Just now, if you've missed the first part of the show, obviously you can go on Spotify or our own BFM app to find the podcast. But now we are actually going to do a used car review, or rather I am going to do a used car review, and Daniel is going to try and make fun of me.
No.
The car in question is an E90 BMW 325i, and I'm going to try and do some sort of ownership review because I think this is the right time to talk about the car. It's becoming extremely desirable everywhere in the world. It's about, 10 to 15 years old now, and it's really starting to become affordable to buy and run. I'll try to be as honest as I can because, as you know, Daniel, I am a BMW guy.
True.
And I think I want to start about what sort of car I was looking for when I first bought this car about 2 years ago.
That's a good way to start.
A few criteria. The first one was which I wanted a nice small saloon wagon or hatchback, something below 60,000 ringgit. The benchmark was sort of like a Proton Suprema, brand new one. I wanted a usable four-seater with a decent-sized boot so I could do road trips and, you know, carry family and all that stuff. It also needed to be a solid driver that I know very well mechanically, that I can grow into and abuse for the next 5 years, of which I will be paying this car off. It needed to be fun because, you know, as car enthusiasts, we want something that entertains us on the way to wherever we're going, right?
Yep, true.
It needs to be reasonably quick, fairly well-built, reliable. And I think with this car, you know, it has a fairly wide aftermarket and service support all over Malaysia and the world. So that's easing my mind when I own a car. The shortlist included a bunch of old BMWs and a few Mazdas, and I didn't really want to go for something Malaysian or Japanese, partly because I like BMWs, and the next best thing other than a BMW was a Mazda. So I spent around 8 months of looking for the actual car that I was going to buy, and sometime in late 2018, I found the perfect car. 63,000 ringgit, slightly over budget, but it was a high-spec BMW, I mean. It's got a sweet six-cylinder, premium audio, navigation, M-Sport kit, all of the best parts. But I think the part that surprised me and a lot of people the most was that the mileage. When I bought it in 2018, the car was about 9 or 10 years old, and it had 36,696 kilometers on the clock.
And you checked to verify that mileage?
Yes, I did. The previous owner was the second owner of the car, and the first owner had kept half the car garaged, so half the car was in the sun, and it was his fourth weekend car or something like that. He would have a Porsche 911 sitting in the garage, so this car was sort of, you know, just left to kind of rot. So the car really needed a lot of tender loving care.
Right.
So it had faded paint, horrible suspension setups that was a bit too low, replica wheels that bent and cracked a lot. It had a lot of broken little bits and warping, dried out window seals and everything. But, you know, for the price at the time, 63,000 was a bit below market value. But I think it was a pretty good deal. And we did talk about this when I first bought the car back then. I'm into my third year of ownership right now. I've driven about 30,000 kilometers in about 2 years and a bit, and I think I know the car pretty well. So just an overview of the E90 generation of the 3 Series. It is the successor to the greatest 3 Series ever, the E46 BMW. We spoke about how good that was a couple of months ago.
True.
But being the highest volume seller of BMW at the time, this E90 needed to be bigger, faster, prettier, packed with more amenities. It needed to grow. It needed to be better than what BMW knew to be the best. So it didn't quite hit those notes when it was launched. I think I remember a lot of people questioning about the way it looked, especially, you know, when BMW launched the 5 Series at the time as well. It just looked a bit weird, didn't it, Daniel?
To me, I liked it. From day one, I liked it. Even today, I look at it on the road. I think the proportions are just right. You know, if you have it in a nice, beautiful paint job and you have it in the original M wheels, I think it looks very, very handsome.
It is a very handsome car these days, right?
Yeah. Despite its age.
Yeah, it's about 10, 15 years old and it still kind of looks brand new.
Yeah.
But, you know, in comparison to the E90, I think people love how small the E46 was. And the E90 was much bigger. It was heavier. It had electrical gizmos that everybody didn't like.
Right.
And then they had slightly less polished driving experience, which we will get into later.
Right.
Still, you know, despite not being so well received, you know, on the technical and mechanical sides of things, when people drove it, they sold 3,076,085 of these cars between 2005 and 2012. They did do a facelift in 2008, which helped hugely. Basically made the car a lot more posh. You got better build quality, better materials on the inside. You got modern technology and better looks. LED lights and some new panels that really made the car stand out even till today. Over the years, they had plenty of engines offering various tunes. A 4-cylinder 143 engine in the 320i. Up to a 450 horsepower V8 in the BMW M3 competition. But today, we are going to be focusing on the naturally aspirated six-cylinder cars, the 323i, the 325i, and the 330i. Why, you might ask? Mainly because the V8s are very expensive to maintain and to run. I mean, the road tax in itself is, what, $4,000 or something like that? The turbo inline sixes are a bit dodgy, the N54 engines, but the four-cylinders, better suited for the 1 Series. I don't think they were powerful enough. By modern standards, the E90, I feel, and perhaps you can chime in on this, Daniel, I feel like this E90 these days has about as much kit as a brand new Honda Civic.
Well, yes, you know, same as any Japanese car has come out right now for about $120,000 to $140,000. Has got a lot of kit. The BMW from 15 years ago has got similar amount of kit, maybe less on the safety toy,
yeah.
You know? But you still get good airbags, good braking system. I mean, end of the day, these cars are very strong, very well built.
Not to mention, when this car was brand new, the E90, it was 375,000 ringgit or something like, God, a lot of money.
You bought it 3 years ago, right?
Yeah, 3 years ago.
So 3 years ago, you bought it for 63,000. Today, what's the value? Can I ask you before you continue?
Today, an equivalent model would be 55.
55. But if you go on the classifieds, they're selling for as low as 38,000 ringgit.
Yep, yep.
And you know why?
Why?
Because there's just too many out there.
Yeah, which is why, you know, we'll get into this later,
okay.
But which is why I think the E90 is a great choice at the moment in 2021. But this 325i, it came with a naturally aspirated inline six engine. So reliability is there.
Right.
215 horsepower, 250 newton meters of torque, 6-speed automatic. You got a lot of kit. I think this model, BMW Malaysia, really packed it with everything. So you got xenon lights, comfort access, auto dimming mirrors. You had sun blinds, cruise control, everything that you could possibly get, like I said, in a brand new Honda Civic.
Right.
Slightly less in terms of the safety, obviously. At first glance, I think it's still a very modern design. It doesn't look that dated. The LED lights add a bit of spice and glamour to it. It's got a lot of neat, sporty lines all over the car. And I find that these E90s, you need to have a really nice set of wheels to get the car sitting really nicely. On the inside, it's well-designed, kind of simple, timeless. Some people might say boring by today's standards. But it's very straightforward, like BMWs were and are right now. You know, everything makes sense. The layout is easy to reach. And I think the nicest part about this car is that it's a bit small in proportions by today's standards, again. It's still got enough space for 4 6-foot adults. And I fit a lot of my friends inside this car, and they seem to have a better time than sitting in a Honda City, which is really the benchmark that I was looking for when I was looking for this car.
But the Honda City, if you had bought a Honda City, it would have been trouble-free for 5 years.
That's true.
because you've got a 5-year warranty. But would you have had 5 years of pure driving entertainment?
I don't think so. That's the thing. Yes. Speaking of driving entertainment, right, this E90, when you sit in it, is really a step back into an era where technology and electronics were sort of like a part of our lives, because that was the time, 2007 to 2009, I think about the first iPhone was launched, right? Mm. All these new social media and technology hasn't yet taken over our consciousness. So this era of cars, you know, the mid-2000s, it's sort of like the nice middle ground between outdated and modern, you know? I think one of the strongest suits of BMWs, and this car, I think part of why I really enjoy driving BMWs a lot, is mainly because of the amenities and the peripherals, which make it an excellent daily driver, a great commuter, because there's so much seat and steering adjustment to find the right driving position for you. You sit nice and snug into the seat. Every button, like I said, is within reach. And, you know, with all the leather, soft touch plastics and cloth everywhere and real aluminium trim, it's really a nice place to get stuck in traffic in.
True. And it's also a driver's car. That's why you got that perfect driving position.
A lot of cars don't seem to nail that, which is kind of a shame, really. Yeah. In terms of ride quality, though, you know, comfort levels are on the stiff side because you got the M Sport suspension and it's got these stiffened sway bars and lower springs and all of those stuff. So bumpy roads like KL, PJ, you're driving around in Ampang, it can get a bit annoying when you're really exhausted after a long day, but I think it still rides super smooth on most Malaysian roads, and it's very, very stable at high speeds. The steering, though, is pretty much point and shoot. I wouldn't say it's the best. It's very much BMW, so you still get lots of feedback through the heavy and chunky steering wheel. You always know where your wheels are going and what they're doing at all times. And this is something that a lot of BMW enthusiasts buy this E90s for, because it's still got hydraulic steering. Compared to the newer ones, the F30 generation has electric steering, which is vague at best, I think.
Direct feel steering is always the best. That's why older cars are more entertaining to drive. But, you know, if you talk to new generation car owners, they don't understand this.
I'm sure.
They have no understanding of what we're saying, and I don't blame them.
In terms of the engine, which is one of the reasons why I bought this car, feels very raw and lively. The red line is 7,000 RPM. So you pass by a toll or you get an on-ramp onto a highway, the car sings, screams, and pulls forever. It's an engine that you love hearing and, you know, doing second, third gear, fourth gear pulls, stretching the revs all the way to 7,000 RPM. But speaking about that second, third, fourth gear thing, I think one of the weakest points about this E90 generation was the automatic gearbox. There's been a lot of problems all over the world about this gearbox, mainly because it can be a bit slow and it's quite indecisive. This generation of BMWs, the mid-2000s, they used three different gearboxes. The early models got the ZF and the GM gearboxes, which were known to be quite unreliable, but they fixed it with a facelift. So if you want to look for an E90, you have to get the facelift, where you might get a bit of peace of mind when you're driving these cars. But, you know, overall, I still think this E90, the drive is reasonably comfortable. I find it very confidence-inspiring because you sit very low in the car and the corners are quite close, so you feel very snug about everything. Is this something that you felt when you test drove this car a long time ago?
When I test drove this car a long time ago, I drove all the variants. And every variant I drove, I just remember only one thing. I mean, it's been a long time, but I only remember one thing. The handling was spot on. The seat comfort was fantastic. I love the fact that the steering feel.
Yeah.
You could feel everything you're driving. It's just like driving my old cars. You could feel everything. And that chunky steering wheel. It's always nice to have a chunky steering wheel.
People hate that though, the chunky steering wheel.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of Malaysians have small hands. When you have large hands, it's okay.
Yeah. And I think another good thing about this E90 is that it's a small car by today's standards. So I think it's a slightly smaller than the brand new 2 Series Grand Coupe that BMW Malaysia launched recently.
You're right.
You go to any parking lot in town, you can fit your car pretty well inside. It's not hard to park. You know, very, very easy to drive because the windows are big and everything. Yeah. Overall, it's a really, really great car, great daily driver, because you can beat on it, you can, you know, grab it by the scruff of its neck and really wind the engine. Or on the other hand, you can just have a nice cruise home,
yeah,
where you rarely go past 80 kilometers an hour. But one of the things that you know, I was worried about when I was buying this car was the ownership. I have never bought a car that's expensive. I heard about all the things that people spoke about, you know, when you buy Continental cars, you know, parts are going to be expensive and all of those things. I'm sure you've heard all of them, Daniel.
Exactly.
But in 2 years and a bit, it's honestly been trouble-free. You know, as someone who likes cars and is willing to spend a bit more money on a nice car, it's not caused me any big headaches at all. It's never stranded me. I don't have any leaks, as far as I know. It's been super reliable. The only things that I had to chase down really was having to repair my cracked and bent wheels 8 times in 2019, which I'm going to send my beautiful thank yous and hopefully my receipts to JKR, because I spent 700 ringgit in 2019 fixing my wheels. You know, in general, because of all its tech equipment and amenities, you're bound to be shocked by major services. And like I said, it's a Continental car. So what do you expect? It's not a Japanese car. It's not a Malaysian car. There are some equipments like xenon lights, which will set you back like $750 just for a pair of bulbs, right, which I almost cried. But at the end of the day, it's what the car is. And if you're willing to afford and to spend money to keep it running nicely, you will be rewarded. I shared my running costs of this car in the previous years on my personal social media. And a few of my friends who drives 2010 Corollas and Civics say that it's kind of in the same ballpark, because the service maybe is 100 ringgit more expensive than a Honda. You know, on some parts, maybe $200-$300. But, you know, I'm inclined to say that it's all worth it. I'll give you some numbers, Daniel, and you'll tell me whether you're surprised, I guess, by this. On the road, to keep the car running, insurance road tax, that's 1,800 ringgit.
Okay, that's fair, because you're 2.5.
2.5, yeah. First year cost to replace all the suspension and the brakes, to get it driving and riding right.
Okay.
Did all the fluids, 6,500 ringgit in the first year.
Okay.
Second year, about the same, 6,500 ringgit as well.
Okay.
Fixing more and things, getting new tires, engine, gearbox mounts. But 2020, last year, because I roughly drove a third of the mileage that I would regularly.
Obviously, because of what is going on.
Yep, because of the MCO. I spent 2,900 ringgit only last year.
Right.
Just on regular service and a few worn things like the famous BMW cup holders that keep breaking all the time.
Okay, so those are interior plastic issues.
Yep. In terms of fuel, I always fill up when I hit quarter tank. So about 50-ish liters, about 100 ringgit, which gets you about 400 to 500 kilometers. I don't think that's pretty bad, right?
That's pretty okay.
Xenon bulbs, as I mentioned, 760 ringgit for the pair. But you buy a Continental car these days, you're going to get that.
No choice. All cars. Doesn't matter whether it's Continental or not.
All cars have xenon bulbs nowadays,
yes,
right? Don't they?
Correct.
Finally, buying tips. I think this is quite an important thing, because over 3 million of these cars and a whole bunch of them are on sale, like Daniel said, below 38,000 all the way up to 60,000 ringgit right now.
Yeah, but I have to say something. 38,000 could be something that has been well used, okay?
Yeah.
But they're starting from the lowest, which is 38, and it goes up to about 40 plus.
And if you really want to go look for an enthusiast run one, you're spending maybe 50 plus for those, right?
Yes.
I would say if you want to look for an E90, you got to look for the six-cylinder cars, because as mentioned before, the four-cylinder just isn't enough, and they tend to have slightly more problems than the six-cylinders. Mm. If you like driving, the 325i is a good one. If you don't really need the extra power, the 323i, which makes about 200 horsepower, you know, is still a great car. But if you see a 330i, which is the non-facelift version, you have to go out and get it, because it's super rare here and it's got 270-ish horsepower. It's a sports saloon without looking like a sports saloon. You know what I mean?
Right. But I'm going to jump in here and say this. For me, if I'm going to get the E90, I want to get a 320D.
Yes.
Pretty rare. I know a couple of people who owned a 320D before. One of them was a very close relative of mine. Hardly any problems. Bang on that horsepower. Beautiful engine. As long as you put in BHP diesel, because BHP diesel is still the best, you're going to have no issue with that car.
Yeah, totally agree. And I was about to say that the later diesels of the E90 had the better gearbox that wouldn't break. So as usual, when we talk about all of these premium cars, I would say always look for the facelift models, because that is when they sort out all the little quality niggles.
Yeah.
That's when they give you a bit more, you know, in terms of technology and safety as well. So 2009 onwards, that's what you should be looking for. Again, as what Daniel says, every used car buying guide, look for a clean car, no unnecessary mods or a history of a breakdown. Bring a mechanic to look it over, especially bring it to a dealer to check with the mileage. because this is a common issue that a lot of prospective buyers face when they see like maybe a 25-year-old car that has super low mileage. You just can't trust that, right?
Correct.
So you have to verify that with a dealer. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say something probably a bit risky here because, you know, reading all the forums, I feel like the mileage for these six-cylinder engines, the N52, kind of doesn't matter, but you have to look for cars around 70,000 kilometers or 130,000 to 170,000 kilometers because that's just after all the major services happen where you have to replace like, you know, brakes, hoses and plastics and gaskets and everything. So I think that's what you should be looking for. And if you read a lot of testimonials online about the E93 series as well, these engines have been proven to last more than 300,000 kilometers if well taken care of.
Right.
And that's the key word there.
Right. So you're saying now that a high mileage car is better to buy than a low mileage car, right?
I'm saying that if you are looking for a car, preferably look for a low mileage. But if you look for an E90 between 130,000 to 170,000 kilometers, if the owner has been responsible, they would have taken care of those mechanical things before selling.
Okay, so that means you need to sell me your car when it's time.
It's about hitting 70,000 now, you know?
You spent quite a bit of money. You've done all the right things. You've not done a lot of mileage, but you've spent, you know, on every little thing that's gone wrong. And the price is now very low. So I think we should talk soon.
Yes. A few common mid-2000s BMW problems that you should look out for when you're inspecting the car. Obviously, when you look inside, the typical Daniel Fernandez statement, have a look at the pedals, have a look at the seat, where it's worn and where it's not.
Yeah.
But the common BMW mechanical problems, when you drive them, it's very important that you don't hear any sounds or knocking from the suspensions, because that's what makes a BMW, the suspension and the ride and the handling. Another thing to look at is at the head gasket, because that's where these engines tend to leak. All BMWs of that era seem to do that.
Yeah.
As usual, worn, cracked, aged plastic cooling systems need to be looked at. You know, it's the typical things to do with a car's age. You know, when with BMWs, the headliners will sag eventually. Mm. The door pulls will start peeling. And anything plastic, even in the Mercedes or Audis or whatever that you're getting, these plastics will tend to warp and crack. And it's part and parcel of what you're getting into when you're buying a used car like this.
Yeah. But if you talk to a lot of people who played with Continental cars, used Continental cars, even me, I will tell you this. Sad to say, if it's a fully imported car, the interior will last longer than a local assembled car. I'm talking about, you know, door panels, carpets, roof lining, little plastic inserts, rubbers, things like that. They seem to last longer with the CBU cars. Also, maybe because the CBU cars, if they're coming in from Japan, they've been weathered less in the sun, you know?
Yeah, that is true. That is true. For the E93 25i, the M Sport, the one that I've got, these are locally made cars. So by virtue of what you just said, my door pulls have already started peeling, and I've replaced my headliner and replaced a lot of other plastic bits in the car as well.
So like I said, you know, when it's time to sell, we should talk, you know, because you've done all the wear and tear that I don't need to do.
So, you know, just to close up this show, I think these E90s, they are seriously affordable right now. You know, between 35 to 55,000 ringgit, my car has depreciated exactly 7,000 ringgit in 2.5 years, which is very little, I think, for a car that's 10 to 15 years old. It's about this time where they start to really crash in prices.
So your car is depreciated about 12%, 11 to 12%, which is very, very sensible because that's what's the depreciation on a Japanese car.
Exactly. So in conclusion, I think it's not too different the way that, you know, in terms of running costs, in terms of the things, it's just that you have to be aware of what to expect when you're running a BMW of this age, I think.
The sad thing is a lot of people have misconception and worry about Continental car maintenance because there are a lot of friends out there who have been played out by mechanics. If you have a good, trustworthy mechanics, these cars are no different than a Japanese or Korean car.
Yep, good, reliable mechanic, and somebody that you can talk to and to bounce off ideas about how you should be replacing these things. That is very useful. But as I mentioned at the start of this part of the show, everybody's starting to sell these cars. So the parts are so easy to source. A handful of these cars I've seen are already heading to scrap yards and breakers around the world and even in Malaysia. Your local mechanic should be able to source you any parts that you can get because a lot of BMW mechanicals are shared across the model ranges. So it's, you know, it's great.
And to end, let's just say this. Buying a used E90 today, like yours, is the equivalent, the price is the same as buying a used old E30 BMW.
Yeah, but my God, I was looking at one of those, but I suppose that's a story for another time.
Exactly.
Anyway, we should end the show because we've run a bit over time. I hope you liked me and Daniel discussing this BMW E90 because it's a great car, honestly. And I hope you didn't mind hearing me wax lyrical about a car that I own. Obviously, I'm going to do that, right?
It's your show.
I guess so. My name is Arif Roos, and you just heard Mr. Daniel Fernandez say goodbye.
Goodbye, ladies and gentlemen, and see you next week. Oh, sorry, hear from you next week.
As usual, you can find this podcast and replay them over and over and over again on Spotify, on any podcast apps that you run, even our own BFM app, or on a website. Don't forget to follow us at BFM Cruise Control on Instagram and Facebook, and don't forget to visit Daniel's website for more complaints about potholes, I guess. DSF.my, that's the website. This has been Cruise Control on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to BFM.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.